Last week we spoke to spiritual economist Dr. Ravi Batra about his belief that the end of capitalism is nigh. By 2016, he reckons, basing his prediction in part on the teachings of Indian guru P.R. Sarkar and the law of social cycles. Dr. Batra struck a chord with you. If you did not catch the interview, you can hear it on our website, radionz.co.nz. Click on Saturday morning. Dr. Batra is just one of a seemingly increasing number of people convinced that the 2008 global financial crisis and the current European disaster mean that another financial system is needed soon. Ralph Manji, for example, he was a global financial trader for investment banks for over a decade in London. For part of that time with the same company that Prime Minister John Key was with, actually. Then Ralph Manji had an epiphany. He started something called the Sustento Institute, which is a policy development organisation. He moved to Christchurch 9 years ago. Ralph Manji says debt is the problem and he has a solution, and he's with me now. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Kim.
This is good news.
Hopefully, if we listen to the message.
Your solution, which you're recommending on a global basis and on a local basis in terms of the renewal of Christchurch, focuses on what you call the debt-based financial system. How would you change it?
Okay, we need to look back in history and think about how money actually comes into existence. I think people today, if you went out onto the street and asked them, where does money come from, they would look rather puzzled and they would think about it for a few seconds and think, oh, doesn't the government create it? Doesn't the Reserve Bank create it? And that's not the case. Since 1688, since William III came to the throne in the UK, the right to create money has no longer been a sovereign right. It was essentially privatized. So the banks were allowed to actually create the money supply. The Bank of England was formed in 1694 as a prime reason for doing this. Actually, it was formed to pay off war debts, but primarily it set the tone for how private banking would work over the next 300 years. Now, the problem with that is the process by which money comes into existence. At the moment, the banks create money in the form of interest-bearing debt. Now, that has a real issue because of compound interest. When money comes into circulation as debt with interest attached, that interest is not actually created. So the interest does not actually exist in the current money supply. And it's that driver that actually underpins the whole financial system. So in essence, and people will understand it, everyone is always borrowing money to pay off previous debt, to fund the interest payments. Now, what we're suggesting is that we go back to how money used to be created by the sovereign, and that governments should issue money, debt and interest-free, into the economy. And the example we gave for Christchurch is that obviously we have to rebuild the city. There's a lot of infrastructure rebuild that is going to happen. So rather than borrowing the money, which the government never has to do, the government should actually create that money itself and spend it directly into the economy. Now, as that money flows around the economy, it has no interest attached to it. It becomes part of the physical money supply, and therefore there is no impetus in that system to drive further debt growth, further borrowing, just to pay off that money. I mean, what we're seeing in Europe and the US at the moment is really a mathematical extension of the debt-based monetary system, where the interest burden absolutely overwhelms the ability for people to repay that debt. And that's when the system collapses. And actually, this has been going on for a long time now. An economist in the UK, Fred Harrison, wrote a book called Boom Bust, 2010, House Prices, Banking and the Depression. And he looked back over 400 years and identified an 18-year cycle. And it's interesting that your economist last week was talking about that. An 18-year cycle, which he tracks all the way back from 1600, of booms and busts.
Yeah, I think that Dr. Batra had a different year cycle, but there are...
Yes, I mean, there's lots of different cycles. I mean, there's long wave cycles and so on.
So I can't quite get my head around. You're saying we run out of money. Our debt's too great. So let's make some more.
No, see, this is I guess, the slight confusion is that Money really is a construct. It's something that we make up to oil the wheels of commerce. Now, the important thing about money is that there's enough money to make sure that we can meet our needs, that people can exchange goods and services. But what we've done is we've commoditized money. We've made it into a commodity that we buy and sell.
Well, you would know.
Yes, absolutely. And then we've created a, you know, certainly in the last 20 years, a whole industry based on what we call derivatives, which is basically, you know, mathematical modeling based on money, which creates these ever more complicated instruments that people can invest in for a return.
And everything's leveraged, right?
Everything's leveraged. I mean, that's really the big problem. I mean, what we're saying is, let's stop issuing money as debt. We don't need to. So, for example, the government bond requirement for next year is going to be around $13.5 billion, which the New Zealand Debt Management Office will issue those bonds. That is going to cost the taxpayer between $600 and $700 million a year in interest. It's absolutely unnecessary. The government can actually create that money itself. It does not need to borrow the money. That is really sort of the key issue here. People assume that when they go to the bank to borrow money, that they're borrowing money from somebody else. Well, they're not. The way the banking system works, and people may be familiar with the fractional reserve system, is it's simply a bookkeeping entry. When the bank is not lending you somebody's money, they're basically creating a loan, and that loan obviously becomes a deposit at the same time, and that deposit has interest on it, the loan has interest on it, and that's where they make their margin. But there's no need for governments to do that. So if, you know, government spending is 30 to 40% of the economy, it's ludicrous that we borrow that money and then pay interest on it. And I think the government debt at the moment is around $70 billion. We're paying $4 billion a year for no reason.
So government debt, however, here is far less than government debt in Europe. And if we compare ourselves with European countries, we say, oh, well, ours is less than 40% of GDP. We're all right. You're saying, no, we're not.
Not really. If we go down the current road, we will end up in a situation like Iceland. We will end up in a situation like Greece. We will end up in a situation like Italy. It's just the way the system goes. I mean, what we're seeing in the US and Europe at the moment, and what we have seen in Japan for the last 20 years, the only reason Japan hasn't collapsed is that they have a huge current account surplus. So people are happy to keep lending the money. And also their interest rates are pretty much at zero. So Japanese government debt is 200% of GDP. But, you know, has there been any problem there? No. But is the economy moving? Not really. So the main problem is the interest. So Italian yields now are over 7%.
What does
that
mean?
That's their real problem. What it means is they're having to pay 7% on their government debt. And that's just too much. They cannot afford that.
So you want to move from a debt-based financial system, a fractional reserve banking, as you put it, to one of full reserve. And the government would make or order the Reserve Bank to issue money to the Treasury to pay for stuff.
Absolutely. Now, I think, you know, the long term aspect of this in terms of 100% reserves, and there are a couple of movements. There's for example, the positive money movement in the UK and New Zealand, and it's starting to spread around the world, are calling for 100% reserves. Irving Fisher, the US economist, called for this. I'm not saying that we have to go there right now. It potentially could be a very long term solution. I think what we need to focus on now is the fact that the government itself does not need to borrow money. The government can bring in what I call good money. So if we call the proposal monetary dialysis, we're bringing in good money and we're flushing out the bad money, which is the interest-bearing debt, which is unnecessary.
There's a consumer caveat that's constantly issued with regard to financial deals. If it sounds too good to be true, then it probably is. What's the downside of this? There's got to be a downside.
No, there's no downside. let me take you back. I'll tell you, the only
why thing... Why doesn't it happen then? If there's no downside, why doesn't it just happen?
Because it's about power, it's about influence, it's about embedded interests, and it's about history as well. And I'll take you back to the US, because this is really, you know, this is really all about the US and the UK, the War of Independence in the US, and the US becoming an independent nation. I'll take you back to what Benjamin Franklin said in 1764, one of the founding fathers. In the colonies, we issue our own money. It's called colonial scrip. We control its purchasing power and we have no interest to pay to no one. And really, the first 150 years of the US was a battle between the people and the banks. all the US, the early US presidents, you know, Jefferson, Washington, Jackson, they were all fighting against the banks. They were all fighting to create a solid money supply which could, you know, help the economy to function. Now, I'll give you an example of the banker's perspective, and this is from the Secretary of the American Bankers Association in 1877, where basically this is after Abraham Lincoln had created the greenbacks, which was, you know, government-issued money circulating around the economy. The economy was doing very well. The bankers didn't like it. So this is what the Bankers Association Secretary had to say. To repeal the act creating banknotes or to restore to circulation the government issue of money will be to provide the people with money and will therefore seriously affect our individual profits as bankers and lenders. And that's really what it was all about. And President James Garfield, in a few years later, said, whoever controls the volume of money in any country is absolute master of all industry and commerce. And when you realize that the entire system is very easily controlled, one way or another, by a few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation and depression originate. And the economist perspective, this was in 1902, Professor Davis Rich Dewey, said the issue of currency is a function of the government, a sovereign right which ought not to be delegated to corporations. Now, if you want to know why we're in the situation we are, it's because the bankers won. And in 1913, the Federal Reserve was created in the US, and that really was the end of the dispute. And since, you know, for the last 100 years, we have had a debt-based monetary system. We've had, you know, the Great Depression. Every 18 years, we've had booms or busts. And I think what we've seen in the last 30 years is the extension, the deregulation of financial markets, and just a phenomenal increase in leverage, so that the system really is totally out of control.
Point of clarification, what was your epiphany? I mean, there you were, presumably happily working in the areas of leverage and debt-based wasset, and suddenly you woke up and what decided you were on the side of the devil?
No, not at all. I think, you know, I was a currency trader, you know, like John Key, and yeah, and it was a fun, enjoyable job. But I think I decided to there are periods when you're trading, you've got big trades on and you're not actually really doing very much. So I took myself back to university and you know, started to get into the whole sustainability movement, and that led me to meet some very interesting people and read some interesting books about the monetary system, how it was constructed, how money came to be created, how the debt-based system actually drove the economy, and also how it drove the economy off a cliff every so often, which is why we have recessions, which is why unemployment goes up, which is why, as I think Ravi said last week, wages are always suppressed. I mean, the Welfare Working Report group here showed that for the bottom 50% of New Zealanders, real wages had not gone up in the last 20 years. That's why people feel poor.
Did the debt-based system work for a while until people carried it through to ridiculous extremes? Or did it?
I mean, it can do, because there's two issues here. One is that we need enough liquidity in the economy. Now, at the moment, what we've seen over the last 2 years...
But can't have too much. I mean, to some extent, the debt-based system must, if working really well in moderation, must bring moderation, must it not?
No, see, that's unfortunately where it's broken down. Traditionally, it might have done, because there were very, very strict limits on how much people could borrow. So yeah. I don't know if you remember, you know, in the old days, it was, you know, two or three times your income. Now, with deregulation in the 80s, all of that went out of the window. And it became, you know, we got to the point where it's, can you pay the interest? That's all that anyone cared about. So the system became a lot more extreme. And then what we saw in 2005 in the US is that the big five investment banks, you know, got together with the Secretary Commission and basically said, look, we can regulate ourselves. We don't need leverage limits. And away they went. And we saw what happened with Bear Stearns and Morgan Stanley and Merrill's and so on and so forth.
Were they stupid or wicked?
They were greedy. They were greedy. And Kim, look, you know, the whole point is people don't know. I mean, people, this is not a judgment on people. People working in the system don't know. So when I educated myself and I
well,
thought...
Well, really?
This
I mean, you
crazy.
Really didn't know how it worked. Even though you were right in there, you didn't know
absolutely
how it worked.
Not. No. And, you know, I'd studied economics at A-level and at university. It's monetary economics is not taught properly at university. And there's, you know, there's a professor of economics at Southampton who's actually saying that academic journals have refused to publish any work in the field of monetary economics, which calls into question the debt-based monetary system. So this is really just, let's be sensible here. We do not need to create money in this way. That
no,
is really the reality.
But if you don't have a debt-based system, which, if it's working with some constraints, I take your point, could lead to some moderation, then what's to stop inflation if you're pushing free money into the system?
It's not free money. It's money that doesn't have interest attached to it. Now, I mean, this is...
Well,
this
that's
is basically...
free money, isn't it? The interest money... is the cost.
No, see, this is if in a way what you've been conditioned to believe, that money should have a cost. Money doesn't need to have a cost. It has a cost because that's how banks make money. All we need actually is a sufficient pool of money in the economy to make sure that we can carry out all of our economic transactions. So in terms of inflation, that's the other part of the piece. The stability of the money supply is extremely important. What people like to know is that the money they've got in their pocket has some value and that it's stable. And I'll give you some numbers over the last 20 years here in New Zealand. This is from like 88 to 08, which is when the financial crisis really hit here. The inflation rate was actually fairly well contained. It rose 65% over that 20-year period. The money supply rose 409%. And at the same time, house prices rose 421%. So the fact is, we have actually had severe inflation here in New Zealand, but it hasn't been reflected in the inflation rate because inflation doesn't measure asset prices. So really, we need to keep a lid on asset prices. We need to keep a stable supply of money, but it does not have to be issued as debt. That's really the point here.
So will inflation not occur under your system, under your non-debt-based system?
No, absolutely not. And you could argue that interest actually drives inflation. Actually, I was reading some work on the Reserve Bank website where they actually were surprised to see that high interest rates can often lead to inflation, because what it does is it creates more demand in the economy for extra money to pay the higher interest rates. So you could actually find that bringing money into the economy without interest is actually going to lead to less inflation as long as the supply of that money is controlled. So, the suggestion we made for Christchurch was $5 billion. That's not a big amount of money. We have a big output gap in the economy. There's a lot of unemployed people. The economy is, operating well below maximum capacity. So we're saying, let's do that. Let's show how it works. Let's show that we can do that. We don't need to borrow that money. Let's save ourselves $200, $250 million a year and start to think about this. And actually, what we really want, and we have been, speaking to the Minister of Finance for several years now with various proposals, is we want to sit down with the Reserve Bank, we want to sit down with Treasury and say, okay, let's have a look at our monetary system. Are there better ways of doing it? There are lots of proposals out there. There's lots of community currencies, lots of mutual credit, barter currencies. There's lots of way of stimulating the economy in a non-inflationary manner and actually having a much more stable supply of money. And that's really what we're calling for here.
And what was the Minister of Economics' response to this suggestion?
Yeah. They tend to generally pat stuff back and say, oh, it's, not something we're that interested in. But I think, the reality is that they need to start opening up now. They need to start opening up the policy formation framework. And they need to realise that there are a lot of people now working outside of government, working outside of the formal channels, who have interesting ideas, who have studied the system a lot. Like, you could call up the Reserve Bank and you could ask somebody on the phone to explain to you how the monetary system works and how banking operates, and you know what? They won't be able to do it, because they get to a point where actually they go, that sort of doesn't really make sense. So you ask them a question, well, why can't the government create money? And they won't be able to answer it. Now, traditionally, people always said, well, you can't print money because of inflation. But that really is a bit of a red herring. Obviously, you want to control the actual supply of money in the economy. And this goes back to the early days of monetarism and Milton Friedman, who was, a big fan of targeting physical monetary aggregates. But they used interest rates. Now, we believe interest rates don't work properly. I think even a lot of people in the Reserve Bank would agree that inflation targeting doesn't particularly work very well. The demand for money is driven by other things. It's specifically whether banks actually want to lend money. And so we believe there are other options.
What's quantitative easing? Is that not what we're talking about?
No. See, this is another problem. This is where the power issue comes. If you think about those quotes from U.S. history and the issue of power interests, what happened in the U.S., and obviously the Japanese started it, is governments thought, OK, well, we need to generate liquidity in the banking system. So what they did is they monetized the debt of the banks. So they basically put liquidity into the banks' balance sheets. But then the banks didn't lend. I mean, if we look how much money is being pumped into the US, I don't know, it's something like $4 trillion now. Where's that money? It's disappeared into the...
Because it was given to the banks.
Because it was given to the banks.
Whereas now, you're saying that if it's injected more directly into the economy...
Yes.
Given to who, though? Where?
You just... Okay, so for you
Me.
Put it into... No, you put it into infrastructure projects. But actually, you could. I mean, even economists like Rubini have actually come round to this point of view. And recently he said what the government should have done is actually directly spent the money into the economy. Because what people are missing is liquidity. There is no money in the economy. Like you go in New Zealand... You know, you try and get a tradesman now, they want to be paid immediately before they even do the job because there is no cash circulating in the economy. Now, what the Americans should have done is injected money directly into the economy through public expenditure. So infrastructure projects, you know, build new schools, build new hospitals, you know, stuff that actually makes sense. Not what they've done in Japan, which is build airports that no one goes
to. So essentially, what you are recommending is an increase in the role of the state. A massive increase
not at all. Because if you think about it, government expenditure is already 30 or 35%. What we're talking about is the way that we finance that. That is really, I mean, we're going to rebuild Christchurch, whatever. It's how we finance that is the issue. But we should stop giving money to the banks. So that's what quantitative easing is basically giving money to improve banks' balance sheets, hoping that banks will do the right thing and go and lend out that money. Well, that's completely ridiculous. We can actually just directly spend it into the economy. The economic activity happens. The interest bill is lower, and therefore that actually has a disinflationary effect. So because people are not trying to get that extra money to pay the interest.
There are other legs to your plan. Participatory universal income is one of them, or as some people have called it, guaranteed minimum income. This is an idea that comes and goes. It's just one single payment to everybody and a flat income tax, no superannuation.
Yeah, I mean, this is slightly different, but the two things are connected.
I was all going to ask you, is do you have to have that in order for the rest of it to work?
No, not at all. This is a kind of welfare reform system. Now, Gareth Morgan's come out with his proposal, the Big Kahuna, which is a guaranteed minimum income. Mm. I mean, where I see us moving to is that in the next 20 to 30 years, the whole jobs market is going to change. Governments are carrying on as if the world is going to remain exactly the same and that there's going to be more and more jobs, etc. We may actually move to a point where technology starts to drive the amount of jobs down. And we will have to face the fact that, you know, to create a decent society, we'll have to recognise that, you know, we may have to change the way that we organise things. But I think the whole welfare system, which really, you know, is a kind of humiliating process regarding people, you know, that don't work as not contributing to society, whereas many of them do. They raise children, which is probably the most important job in society. They look after people who are sick. They do voluntary work in the community. You know, they are making a contribution. And, you know, I work as a budget service advisor, and I've yet to meet a client even who's, you know, in terrible debts, who doesn't want to pay it back, who doesn't want to get a job. So I think a more efficient way of doing that is actually to just say to everyone, OK, we will give everybody a basic living income so that they can live on that. And we will give that to everybody. We will eliminate welfare completely. There'll be no more WINS. There'll be no more means testing. There'll be no more need for superannuation because you'll get it for the whole of your life. We'll reform the tax system so that we start to remove taxes from income and we put taxes on resources. So, for example, a land tax. And again, the Reserve Bank and Treasury have done plenty of work on this. And there's lots of people there who actually support that. Creates a much more efficient system. It's a much more dignified system in terms of it values all the different types of contributions that people make within society.
What if they don't contribute? I mean, what if they just, you know, sit in their bedroom and eat instant noodles?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was the
Sounds
famous...
tempting, doesn't it? I know.
Well, I think it was the US philosopher John Rawls coined the term Malibu surfers. And maybe we'd have, I don't know where people surf in New Zealand, but we might have the same thing here. That's really, you know, again, it's another one of these red herrings that you get a little bit like sort of, oh, what about inflation? The reality is not true. What I quite like about a participatory income, now some people think it should be universal regardless, is that we want people to participate in society. So it doesn't matter what you do. You may have, a lot of people will still be working because they want to have, you know, a sort of a more expensive lifestyle. People might be raising children. People might be doing voluntary work, community work. People might be doing coaching or mentoring in the community.
Well, they might be, but yes. There are people who won't be. Do you just ignore them?
I think that's why you can make it a participatory income. So there's an element of coercion. But I think it's actually trying to get our society back on its feet. I think, unemployment has, what it does to people and the kind of the vindictive nature that is applied to beneficiaries, it's unhelpful. It creates a dysfunction in our society. And I think we can do things a lot smarter. And the fact is, this is not a new proposal. It has been around for a long time. But I think the time has come in terms of the way the financial system is imploding, that we need to sit back and actually look more closely at where society is going, the makeup of society, what jobs are going to look like in the future, and realise that there's lots of different types of contributions that people can make.
What do your former colleagues say about your ideas?
I think some of them actually appreciate them. But, the reality is, Kim, I mean, people have to earn a living, and I have friends who still work in the markets, and they're great people, and they're just sort of doing little jobs, within the bigger system. So, I'm not being judgmental about what anyone does. What we have identified, and what has been identified for a long time, is that there is a real problem with the way the system is structured. That is the key thing. So I think, people, friends of mine appreciate the work that I'm trying to do, and that, they think, Raf's got another idea. So I think a lot of people agree with what's going on.
What do you think is going to happen in Europe, as briefly, as we can deal with this calamitous situation? I mean, many commentators, I was reading Brian Gaynor, who says, eventually New Zealand's going to go down the same track as the pigs, so to speak, and now France.
Well, we can avoid that completely. If we follow this proposal, we can avoid that completely. In terms of what's going to happen in Europe, they have two choices. They either have full fiscal integration, or people start to leave. It's as simple as that. There is no way in the middle. The fudging that goes on, and the reality is, Kim, that the leaders in charge, they don't really understand the system. They don't understand what underpins it, and therefore they try to create solutions from, if you like, the current toolbox. And the current toolbox just doesn't work. So either everybody gives up their fiscal sovereignty, which is basically their ability to tax, and they allow the ECB to take that over. That is a possibility. And if you're a real Europhile, you could say, look, guys, let's, we went halfway with monetary union. Let's just go the whole hog and create the United States of Europe. Mm. If people don't want to do that, and there may be some issues around that, then, Greece has to leave the euro. The problem is there is no ability for countries to lower their exchange rates to rebalance their economies. And that's a problem that we have here in New Zealand, is that the exchange rate's been ignored for years, and we've allowed the carry trade to completely, destroy our current account deficit.
It's all right. Well, if we took back our financial sovereignty by moving from the debt-based financial system, effectively, and issuing new money, how would that affect the free trade, the globalization, our dealings with the rest of the world?
It won't affect it at all. Because what I'm saying right now is, let's focus on the government debt, okay? Let's leave the private debt to one side for the moment.
Right.
So I'm saying, hey, let's dip our toe in the water and let's see what happens. So,
and government debt, gross crown debt,
yes,
is what, like 76 billion now?
Yes. I don't know what the gross number is. The net number is 71 billion at the moment.
Right.
So we're paying 4 billion a year. It's ridiculous. $4 billion a year, and we've been paying it forever. It's a waste of money, and New Zealanders are suffering because of that.
I'm not asking for a rallying cry from you, but do you sense more now than before, and you've obviously got a sense of history, that there is a call for a change that will not be resisted?
I think so. I think what we're seeing with the Occupy movement, which clearly they haven't articulated this type of thing.
But Dr. Batra has articulated it for them, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think that's right. Yes, often in life, everything's about timing. Like I made a very similar proposal at the House of Lords in the UK 10 years ago, and it became an early day motion in Parliament, and it just never really went anywhere. But it's all about timing. And so the system is falling over, and I think more and more people are starting to realise that we need to do something. People are doing things at the community level, like time banking we've got here in New Zealand, community currencies. We have some new candidates coming forward in the elections. There's a couple of independent candidates standing in Wellington for the new Economics Party, which is
Not electioneer.
No, but what I'm saying is that there is a shift. There is a shift in people's thinking that they are more prepared to think, OK, is there an alternative solution? But there is one problem that I should mention.
Yes.
And the problem comes from agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which
yes.
are being negotiated in secrecy, which may restrict our ability to even do things like issue our own money. So we have to be very, very careful that we do not negotiate our sovereignty away. It already has, to a large extent, been negotiated away, but we can reclaim our sovereignty and we can put our country back on its feet and we can make it a prosperous country for all people.